and I'm mentally tired more than physically. And then Nuke again, I remember talking to him, he's going, "Hey, you know, how are you going?" I said, I told him how I was feeling. He's, "What are you talking about, mate? Like, you are playing a grand slam.
Right.
Get your head in the game. You drop it short, I'm in. I'm not going to miss." And I was moving really well. And I was probably at my peak in 98. So I'm a set all, sitting down and going, "I'm done." You know, it was such an awful feeling.
More emotional than physical.
Oh, 100% emotional. But that emotion affected my whole physicality. A terrible feeling.
You need a Nuke at that point.
Oh, so, yeah. He would have ripped into me.
Obviously, you played against Roger when he was young. Actually, I think you're the only guy to beat him on all three services. You know
that's
that?
That's true, mate.
He was young, but you still beat him.
Irrelevant.
All right, Patrick McEnroe here with the man, Pat Rafter. We're in Australia at the Australian Open. Patty, great to have you with us. First, I want to ask you about the Laver Cup, because you and I got to do the press conference together. I was the vice captain for the last 7-8 years, and they stepped it up big time, bringing in a real Hall of Famer and Pat Rafter to be the vice captain. So how do you feel about that?
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, Andre asked me to do it, and I went, "Yeah, sure, let's have some fun." And Andre wants to take it very serious, and I said, "Yeah, mate, listen, I'm engaged. Let's go for it." And we just go through the process now. And, you know, I said to him, "You know, what's the commitment?" He said, "Well, it's not a lot. It's just, you know, 1 week and watch some tennis and things." And I'm going to probably take it upon myself to go that a little bit step further, because I don't watch a lot of tennis generally, but it will come now that I will start knowing the names. I'll be watching the players all the time, and now I'll be watching week in, week out. I got sort of dip your toe back in, you know, and into tennis a little bit, and that's the way in. And I'm sort of looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah, and you get to play a little bit here in the Legends during this year's Australian Open, and always great to see you back on the court. And, of course, we go back. By the way, the theme of our Hall of Fame podcast this month is tenacity. Oh. And having gotten my butt kicked by you on a couple of occasions, you were always known, obviously, as one of the great serve and volleyers, but also for your tenacity, for your attitude out on the court. And I know you take a lot of pride in the history of Australian tennis. You talked about that during the Laver Cup press conference. So maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what it means to you to be one of the all-time Hall of Famers from Australia, having followed in the footsteps of so many all-time greats.
Okay, so it's sort of a double-pronged question there. So first of all, but you know, we talk a little bit about tenacity as well, and the reason I got to where I was is because I had a fair bit of resilience in my game. But I often wonder why some people have it and some people don't. And in a way, I feel like you're nearly born with it. Obviously, you can work on it and you can get better and stronger. We saw someone like Roger Federer get better over the years. He came out a little bit soft and he got better, better, stronger and tougher. And he became then this complete package. And he'll be the first to admit that as well. And, you know, with me, I don't know, I was the seventh of nine kids, and you had to fight for your way. And I did that with the older brothers. And, you know, you got sort of knocked around a little bit and you had to show a fair bit of resilience to get up and find yourself again. And also my tennis game itself, I was sort of knocked around a lot as well and had to try to find the positives. And the game never really put me off. You know, I was always disappointed. But anyway, I stayed with the game and then loved the game and then became fascinated with the learning of it all. And that was sort of the steps and the stages. And then the chess game, you know, you're playing with the person all the time, trying to, you know, one better them, or how do I get out of this tight situation, or how do I get into this guy's head? And the game itself was so big in Australia because of all those legends we had before us. And, you know, I actually don't always like saying the names.
Yeah, because you don't want to miss someone, right? Don't worry.
Exactly right.
We, you know, Hoad, Laver, Rosewall, Newcomb. You know, Stolle. Yeah, I'm going to miss one. That's okay. We don't be offended if we missed one, because there's so many.
M.O.
Rochi.
Rochi, as you said. So that history was in us from such a young age. And I remember playing a under-14s tournament, and I'm in the locker room with the change rooms back then. I'm just an outback Queensland tournament and saying, "I'm going to play Davis Cup for Australia." And a mate beside me would, the mate would say, and I'm going, "Gee, really? We're so far away from that." You know, but that's what it meant to us, to be part of this team and part of Australia, and what it meant to us. So those names that went before us built the tradition of tennis in Australia, and it sat really deeply with me. And it's a legacy I hope that we never lose. Sometimes I think that, you know, maybe the modern day kid doesn't find the passion with it, but at the same time, there's always those one or two that do, and they surprise you when they bring up some of the stats from the old days, and it's pretty cool to listen to them talk about it.
Yeah, the world is definitely changing in that sense. And you know, there's been some other great Australian players right around your time, since your time, that maybe didn't embody that same spirit of great Aussies that definitely you did. But from a game style, I mean, you're kind of old school serve and volleyer, but you also weren't a player that could dominate, you know, with the ground strokes, right? Like a lot of players can. So for me, watching you over the years, I always marveled, because you did have to work extremely hard the way that you played. You couldn't just, you know, even your serve was really good, but it wasn't ultra powerful. So it was more of a setup shot for your volley game. And same with your ground stroke. So to me, when I think of Tenacious, I do think of you, because I think you had to work your butt off to do what you did.
You're right. You summed it up perfectly, Pat. You know, it was about setting up for a volley most of the time. And, you know, you sometimes get in a panic mode at four, juice, and you know you're serving against Andre, and the last thing you want to do is pick a volley off your toes. So you might go for a big serve to try and finish the point a bit earlier, and hopefully you get the thing in. So, yeah, you're right. It was the serve was about shape and hitting your spots, mixing it up, variation to get a volley. You know, how do I make this guy who's returning, who's such a great returner, hit sort of the outside of their racket a little bit more? If they get the return in the middle of the racket, I'm probably not going to get a volley. So it's about, how do I create uncertainty for their return? So that was how I served. And then, you know, the game itself, I knew my ground strokes were not good. They weren't that powerful. But how do I put them into places that are awkward for the other guy? How do I upset their rhythm all the time? How do I get to the net and take my chances at the net? Because I figured I'm 50-50 once I chip charge and come in, and sometimes I pick away. They're better odds than when I am sitting at the baseline. And then every now and then when I'm at the baseline, I might go, you know what, I'm just going to tee off. I'm going to go for something because they're not expecting it. Mm-hmm. And a rally doesn't suit me. The longer this rally goes for, the worse I'm going to be. So what are the percentages, you know, in my favor? Let's go for a big shot every now and then. But also, you're upsetting the rhythm. You're not letting them dictate and control, you know, the baseline rallies. So there was, you know, it sort of worked in many favors for me to make those points shorter. But then I'll dink a few around, and you recognize a point at 4-30, or you're probably not going to go for that big shot, but you will try to create an opening in the court where you get to the net and hopefully finish the point off there.
You know, those days when you were in your prime in the mid 90s, and then obviously into the early 2000s. But I remember playing here in Australia, and I remember the conditions always being quite a bit slower than they are now. And the US Open, of course, is always a little bit quicker, which is where you won your two majors. Was that frustrating for you? Because I always felt like, you know, if the courts were quick here, it would have been a great situation for you. And there was the old rebound ace, remember, before they switched to the cement, which is a little bouncier, and I thought a little bit harder for a serve and volley player. Did that annoy you?
You know what I found hard? And I actually been playing some, as I said, some of the old man stuff out here now, and I'm finding the courts still not overly receptive in a way for my game. Now, the US Open was a lively ball and a grippy court and fast. But when I say grippy, it would take my serve. So I like to do a lot of kick on my serve, and I could get some good bite out of the court. So the ball would hit the court and then bounce out of the hitting zones. I'm hitting a few serves out here, and I'm not getting that. Although it's quick and it's bouncing quite high, I'm finding that the ball's more sliding into their zones better than what it is kicking out of their zones, which is my serve was more of a kick serve than a slice serve. So, yeah.
Well, take me back to that 97 final, you know, your first U.S. Open win, and you're playing Ruzetsky, who had a bigger serve, maybe not a better serve, and certainly you were quicker around the court. What was that like in that, you know, to win your first one there?
Yeah, so I went through the process of getting through to, you know, quarters, semis, and coming up against Chang in the semifinals, and that was a big match for me because he was also going for the number one position at that time. And I sort of was like, you know, I've got a chance out here. I didn't give myself the biggest chance, but I gave myself a decent chance. and just played flawless tennis. And then went in against Vizetsky, and all of a sudden the pressure's on me because I feel like I should be beating
you. The favorite.
Yeah. I'm the favorite now, exactly. Yeah. And leading up to that, I didn't feel any match as that. So it was a whole different mindset until Nuke sort of snapped me out of it. And I've talked to him, you know, that morning. Yeah, how are you feeling? Good. Yeah, well, I've lost the last six finals throughout the year, and I'm playing a guy I should beat. I'm sort of a little – and he said, what are you talking about? You're playing great tennis. And he, you know, the words that –
He was there in person? Or
he was. Yeah, he was calling for Channel 9 back in Australia. Right.
He used to call a lot for Solly. Yeah, he used to call a lot for CBS back in the day when I was growing up. I used to listen to him. Yeah.
He was pretty synonymous with Australian tennis in the 80s and 90s and his voice. So he was a big commentator. So he was there. Rochi was preparing me and just getting ready for the match. So, as you said, Rozetsky had a big serve, but he had flaws in his game, which I found I could exploit. I could get to him. Although I didn't have the greatest return, I was able to create enough uncertainty in his game, which suited the way I played. I mean, I'm not going to go into details, but, you know, the thing was, at the end of the day, I had it on my string when it came to the finals. Mm-hmm. And it was more about how do I deal with this emotionally and mentally, and how do I keep my game plan intact and also the confidence without getting too nervous and being restrictive in the way I played. I know, and it flowed for me. And Rozetsky didn't play, you know, really open tennis either, though. You know, he was a little bit tight and nervous. He was in his first Grand Slam final. So it was two pretty tight young guys playing each other, realizing there probably aren't going to be many opportunities to win a Grand Slam in our career. And we had one all of a sudden. So it played to me again, my favor. He was a bit tight. I was a little bit less tight and coming up with a game plan which I thought was better than his, and the way it played out was the way it played out, and I ended up having my first win. And I just felt very different in 98 when I played the US Open. It was a whole different mindset. I was so much freer.
Well, you also had an unbelievable summer. US summer. You'd won the two Masters events, I believe, back to back, right? Yeah. Since Canada and Cincinnati.
And then won Long Island the week before.
Yeah.
And then went into the US Open. I must admit that the first couple of rounds were a little bit tricky because I was pretty flat and tired. Mm. And I'm mentally tired more than physically. I was pretty fit. And then Nuke again. I remember talking to him. He's going, hey, you know, how are you going? And I told him how I was feeling. What are you talking about, mate? Like, he would rip into me. He was perfect. You are playing a Grand Slam.
Right.
Get your head in the game.
Yeah.
And then from third round onwards, I was in. But, you know, the first two matches I played, I wasn't in a great headspace. I was lucky to win my first round match against Arazi, and then I sort of got through the second round match okay. But, you know, I was flat. Until he snapped me out of it. And from then on, I played great tennis.
Yeah, I mean, the final was, was that the perfect match?
Yeah.
I believe again. It was six unforced errors, I believe, made in the final against your mate, Philippoussis, who, of course, was, you know, coming in with a lot of confidence, a lot of firepower.
Mm. And I think the fourth round and quarterfinals also were like that as well. Uh-huh. I mean, I came in making no errors. But I'm also a serve volleyer.
Right.
So when there's unforced errors different to a forced error, I'm making a lot of forced errors, but not unforced errors, if you know what I mean. So I sort of get a little bit more leeway when it comes to
the actual stats.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But I do remember when you were playing your best that you maybe didn't hit a lot of winners from the baseline, but you didn't miss.
Mm-hmm.
You That's really true. Didn't miss. You were so steady, so consistent, and obviously, you know, playing against you, your opponent would know, if I leave anything short, this guy's all over me.
And that was exactly right. You drop it short, I'm in. I'm not going to miss. And I was moving really well. And I was probably at my peak in 98. I wasn't making
it. Where did that come from, that amazing movement? I mean, obviously you were naturally quick, but what kind of work did you do off the court for that?
A lot of agility work, a lot of speed work, and a lot of power work. So we would do a lot of the work on court in particular, a lot of really short, sharp stuff, and a lot of, we call them two-on-ones. Mm-hmm. You know, back then, two at the net, one at the baseline, and vice versa. Burning the legs, making you do really powerful things for 5 minutes, because that's really how you probably, after 2 minutes, you're shot. But you do another 3 minutes of trying to get as much
That's
power.
Old school Aussie stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Lactic. And you're just going, we're not going to stop. And Rochi wouldn't let you stop. And then you just kept going and it was really explosive work. And then off court, short, sharp sprints, 5 meter, 10 meter sprints. And you do that for half an hour. And then you'd be also doing a lot of leg volley work, you know, where you're just going out volleying wide, volleying strength work and lactic acid, getting back for smashes on grass, you know, like on softer surfaces right. and not with a racket in your hand, but sort of emulating how you would play a tennis point at the net that went on for a couple of minutes. So those type of – and then I kept that going on for the rest of my career, but particularly then I just seemed to be probably at my peak in terms of movement.
Talk to me a little bit about, you mentioned Agassi, you had some great matches with him, such different styles, obviously. Sampras, you know, he kind of had a little attitude towards you, but he had that towards everyone. And you played him in some big matches as well. And he had the serve volley game, but more power, you know, a little more explosive. What was that rivalry like for you going up against him? Because he was sort of the guy during those years.
Yeah. Oh, Pete was the greatest player of our generation, and I'm sure he'd be really effective in any generation. As you said, big serve, he had a bigger power game than I had. You know, you just hope you got Pete on one of those sort of average days. You know, he when his forehand wasn't on, and there were times when his forehand wasn't on that you could exploit him. His backhand was always okay. He chipped it around, but you'd always felt like I'd be in the match with Pete. And it wasn't like Andre where he'd blow you off the court. Pete could blow you off the court with his serve, but his returns weren't that great. So you could get to four all. You know, he might put in a double here and there. When he wasn't playing his best tennis, and that was definitely in 98, and that's when I took advantage of a lot of tournaments around the place, was, you know, Pete being out of the action and Andre, who still wasn't at his peak yet. You know, he was still sort of coming back. He was good in 98, but it wasn't until 99 onwards when Andre started playing great tennis, winning lots of Grand Slams. So Pete at that time was he had a better forehand, a better ground stroke game than me, a better serve. Volleys were sort of different. I mean, he wasn't your classic serve volley. I don't know if you ever watch him move to the net. We tried to work on like your Pat Cash, your Stefan Edberg was your serve. You come in two or three steps. I can't remember what it was. Split step,
move to the volley. Yeah, cover the angles. Pete was going to kind of relied, I think, a little more on his athleticism.
Exactly.
You know, whereas you guys, like you and Cashy and Edberg, you were like methodical in the way you approach it. You're also obviously very athletic, but in a different sort of way where you could cover the angles better. Because that was where, you know, especially you, that's where you made your bread and butter, right? Mm-hmm. And I felt like you had that old really Aussie style of prepping and, you know, covering the angles, whereas Pete was kind of freewheeling it a little bit. He got away with it at times because he was such a great athlete.
Great athlete, mate. He was explosive. When Pete wanted to move, he moved. I don't think there was a quicker, more explosive guy on the tour. We always spoke about Chang and then Hewitt being fast, but no one got to balls like Pete when he wanted to, you know, because he went through the motions a lot of times on the court. But when there's, you know, if it's a big point to be played, he put the afterburners on and he took off.
And in those, give me a little bit on the Wimbledon finals, because you were
2000.
Yeah, 2000. Yeah, because well, I mean, you were so close a couple of times.
Yeah. Well, Pete was sort of had a bit of an ankle problem then too, and he was sort of going, it's pretty sore, and he I think he took some medication to be on that court in that match. I was sort of aware of it, but you don't want to sort of go out there knowing that someone's half injured or.
Just ask Carlos Alcaraz from this year's Australian Open. Oh,
and then, you know, you don't want that going on the back of your mind. And Pete didn't make a song and dance about it. He just went about his business. And, you know, I got the first set in a tight set. It was pretty ugly tennis, but I was holding my own, and then got to the second set tiebreaker. Again, no one's broken serve yet. And I get up 4-1 in the breaker and double break. So I'm serving to go 6-1 up, and I choke. As simple as that.
Really?
The nerves were just horrible. I just overtook my game. I felt it. My heart rate went to 1,000. I could not control it. I'd just make a great return of 3-1 and he'd miss a half volley.
Right.
You know, 4-1. I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to win this set.
You could be up 2 sets
and then
to
I'm going to be, then I'm going to be playing a lot freer.
Right.
And then Pete's ankle is going to be hurting a fair bit more. Right. That's just the psychology of the game.
Sure.
So I felt like I had it won effectively. And then, you know, things happened. I got too tight and too nervous and wasn't effective on my serve and did a double fault and missed a forehand at the bottom of the net when I had an easy chance. And those emotions just got the better of me. And I just went, oh, sort of put my head down. You know, not the emotions of going off you know, like angry and smashing rackets. It was like head down, sort of knowing the feeling, arm not moving real well, feet aren't wanting to move.
Right.
Just going, I think I'm gone. You know, just, and that whisper to myself was awful. Knowing the high of the adrenaline rush and then the flatness. So I'm a set all, sitting down and going, I'm done. You know, it was such an awful feeling.
More emotional than physical.
Oh, 100% emotional. But that emotion affected my whole physicality. A terrible feeling.
You need a nuke at that point.
Oh, so, yeah. He would have ripped into me.
Imagine if you had the coaching now that they have. Do you think that could have helped you?
He would have needed, seriously, to come on and slap me around the face.
Yeah.
I reckon if you could have done that and if we're accepting that, I would have certainly accepted a slap in the face from him. Probably wouldn't look too good on TV, but back then I might have got away with it.
Right.
You know, so maybe would have gone off court to do it. But having the coaching would have been really beneficial for me, especially someone like Nuke. But I think he was commentating. But I reckon he would have come out of the booth to give me a kick up the
bum. Give you a little, say, hey, this is the Wimbledon final. You're still in this.
Yeah, exactly, mate.
Now, let's fast forward to the Ivan Isevich final, which was carried over. Of course, it was, you know, amazing crowd, amazing
on Monday,
energy on a Monday. And what were you thinking about going into that?
Had him. Yeah. I'm not losing to Goran. I know he had a great run at Wimbledon, but I'd had some good success against him the last few times we played. He was pretty average for a year and a half, 2 years. He wasn't playing great tennis, although I know he was getting through, but I didn't know how he was getting through those matches. And just went in with full of confidence. I won the toss, served first. I was tight. I lost my opening service game. It's like, God. So then that set was gone 6-4 pretty well. And then I won the second. He played a pretty good game somewhere in the third, but he held his serve again. You know, we're talking about big servers and hard to return, gone very fast.
And the grass was quite a bit different than it is
quick,
now.
Quick and slick.
Yeah.
And that confidence of being up a break was meant so much. And having the pressure and expectation of breaking was, you know, was on you all the time. And then I double broke him in the fourth set to win at 6-2, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he was starting to get a bit upset.
Right.
Anyway.
He could do that.
Yeah. He could. And then with at 5-4, I think it was, and no one had any opportunities until 5-4 on his serve when I had love 30.
Right.
And it was 5-4 to me. And, you know, 2 points away from the match. Had a couple of second serves to look at as well. But he, you know, you got to take my hat off to him. He went out wide in the first court. And so that's a hard serve.
That's a hard serve for the lefty to hit. Yeah.
You know, he kicked it hard and went out there with a big serve. He caught me off guard. I made an average return or may have even missed it. And then had another second serve return at 5:30. And he hit the chalk down the middle. He went T.
Basically went for an ace.
He did.
Yeah.
And I was there again, made it, but he put away the volley. And I was like, again, I can't remember which one. I missed one of them and made a return. But it's like, mate, too good. You know, in a way. And I was feeling nervous but excited, not choking nervous. Anyway.
Different than the Sampras match.
Oh, totally different.
Yeah, totally different.
You know,
yeah.
And then went through some service games and then he hit 4 clean winners on one of my service games.
Which he could do. Yeah.
Which he could do too.
Yeah.
7 all or whatever it was.
Right,
I came
right.
6 or 7 all. So, and, you know, that's tennis for you. And then he was tight on his service game. And I was trying to make him play as much as I could, but how do I make it? You know, get him in.
Right.
And he had 3 or 4 match points. He was double faulting. He was missing easy shots. And I knew I had to get the ball back. But again, big lefty serve. Sometimes you can't make them all.
Well, he was close so many times. So it was almost like, you know.
He was destined.
He was destined to win one, which on a Monday was an incredible atmosphere there. When you look at the current game, and obviously you played against Roger when he was young. Actually, I think you're the only guy to beat him on all 3 services. You know
that's
that?
True, mate.
He was young, but you still beat him.
Irrelevant.
But when you look at what you know he did and what Rafa did, and now Novak is still doing. Uh-huh. You know, while we're talking, we're here during the Australian Open, actually in the middle of it. Does it amaze you at how those three have taken the game? And then when you see, you know, the younger guys coming up, how the game has evolved since you stopped?
Yeah, well, the game has evolved because of the string. And it was coming in towards the end of my career, watching balls drop out of the sky and going, landing in and just sort of hitting a volley and watching it drop down at my toes. All of a sudden, it was at knee height and it was at my toes. And I didn't know what was going on. So that was the one part of the game that changed significantly. But then watching those three guys they actually pushed themselves, or they pushed each other. They all wanted that title of the most Grand Slams, right, the greatest ever, because we're an amazing generation where they just totally dominated. And we only saw, I think, three outside win with Murray.
Murray won a couple. Wawrinka won a couple.
And
Del Potro won one.
Oh, Del Potro won one. That's right. Yeah. Del Potro. So yeah. Four. Yeah. So that was effectively during their dominance was all that
won. It was incredible. Yeah.
And they all wanted it. You know, they all wanted to, you know, who they're all round 20 and who's going to get to this. And then they kept going to their late 30s. And they had different styles and movement. You saw Roger so graceful and, you know, his knees gave way. I don't know, what was he, 38, 39? 38,
yeah.
When he stopped. Rafa, I mean, his body, he was, how he kept going. He was a total
beast. We thought he'd be done by the time he was 30. Exactly. And he still played into his mid-30s.
And I hope his body's okay now, you know, when he retires and he's my age. And
you're still pretty young bloke, though.
I'm saying good nick. Yeah. Because I stopped at 28 too. Yeah. Was the other thing. And then watching Novak now at 38, cruise around, but they're in such great shape, look after themselves very well. But yeah, you know, the desire and passion is still there, and that's what you need. I didn't have it. I certainly, you know.
At 28, you said you had enough, or was it the body gave out?
Yeah, a little bit of the body, but mine too. You know, I was happy. I wanted a new life, and I walked away from the game. And that first year was tough. You know, always talk about that transition from a professional athlete into, I wouldn't say the word obscurity, but you talk about retirement or whatever it might be. Tough for a lot of people, but it wasn't that as hard for me as it was for most. And after 1 year, I was just so happy I'd given the game up.
And you happy enjoying your life in Australia. Mm. And I have to say, we at the Hall of Fame loved having you up at the Hall of Fame as we did just in the last year, which was great. And to see you now getting back to do the Laver Cup, I think is going to be great for the Laver Cup. And we in the tennis world are very happy to have you back part-time. You know?
Thank you, Pat. No, it's good to have a look back at it and get involved a bit.
And just lastly, being a Hall of Famer, you know, and we're trying to spread the word of the Hall of Fame to the world. I don't think we have that problem here in Australia because of the great history here and the traditions here. But what does it mean for you, Pat Rafter, to be a Hall of Famer?
Mm. Yeah, it's a funny one because I see it like you see it as unbelievably special and significant in your career if you can get in there. And not everyone's going to get in there.
The ultimate honor, we call it.
It is. Yeah, I agree, mate. It is that. It's one of those feathers in the cap you get, which is like doesn't get any bigger than this to be recognized in the sport as one of the Hall of Famers. And we see it in other sports. I think Americans do it very well.
Yes. Yep.
And it's significant, but it's, you know, they're American sports. But the Hall of Fame means so much to the Americans. And the Europeans probably don't get it as much as the Aussies do because, I don't know, for some reason we recognize it.
Right.
And we see it as a really important part of our lives to be part of that. If we're in the tennis community, to be part of the International Hall of Fame. We have our own Australian one. Bit easier to get into than the international one.
still pretty tough though. Mate, yeah.
It's still amazing and for what it is. And if the Europeans can embrace it, I would certainly like to see them, you know, spread the word. And I know you have Kim Clijsters on the board and she's very passionate about it. And hopefully she can get it out to those players. But every one of those European guys and girls that get inducted, you know, they're there.
Right.
They do understand it.
When they get there, they get it. Yeah.
They do. And the community, then hopefully they can embrace it more. And the people, you know, just your general Joe Blows down the street can understand how important it is, because when we get introduced out here as a player, you know, it's won two Grand Slams, won the World Hall of Fame, International Hall of Fame. You know, you get recognized and understood here.
Well, Pat, I appreciate you joining me on our Hall of Fame podcast. You're my first official guest.
Unreal. Thank you, Pat.
You're a legend on the court and off the court, and we appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Patty.
Thank you.